Now, it's a good segue to a Kim Jong-il production by Paul Fisher, a book that's just out. You know, you'd like to know more about North Korea, and you can't seem to get at it. And this is this doesn't help, I'll tell you the truth. It's a fascinating book. It's a great story of a film director and a leading actress of South Korea at the time who were kidnapped by Kim Jong-il and North Koreans so they could improve the North Korean film industry. Because he was a film buff, and well, I'll let Paul Fisher tell you more about it. He's in New York City right now. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Yeah, are you on a book tour now for this?
I have been, and I'm just sort of finishing up, and then I go to Europe next week because it's coming out there in different languages.
Yeah, different languages. Were you able to get into Pyongyang and to research this?
I was. Yeah, I spent about a week there. Under the guise, I'm a filmmaker by day, so under the guise that I wanted to kind of see their filmmaking facilities in case I wanted to make a film with them or suggest to make a film with them.
Uh-huh. Was that your first trip?
It was, yeah. So yeah. I don't think they'd let me in anymore, or if they would, they wouldn't let me out after.
Yeah. You're a director and a film producer yourself, but were you familiar with the North Korean film program?
I wasn't, no. I haven't made a film in a long time, and when they used to make them, they were really, really bad.
Yeah.
So there's no real reason to watch them unless you're, you know, writing about it out of specific interest.
Yeah. You're kind of drifting in and out on us. Can you hold your head out the window there in your New York high rise? Just stick your head right out the window and have someone hold your ankles. It shouldn't be a problem. Are you still there?
Yeah, here.
I thought I'd hear you going.
Whoa!
Okay. Anyway, all right, and so this story is rather amazing, and it's all true, and does the story come from their memoirs itself, or how did you piece it all together?
Their memoir was the main bit, and then there are, there's a bunch of accounts of people who were around at the time, who were involved with Kim Jong-il at the time, who might have been in the same places, same rooms, and you can kind of piece it together from all these different, you know, eyewitness accounts, pictures, maps, all that kind of stuff. That was the process.
Yeah. So Kim Jong-il, who was like the second of the Kims, his father was Sung,
yeah.
Right? And it was the great leader, whatever. And then he's the son. And he started to make his name. He started making movies. But he was also obsessed with Western films.
He was, yeah. His favorite films were, you know, James Bond films, Friday the 13th, Rambo. he was obsessed with, you know, kind of blockbustery American 80s films.
Yeah.
And there's a feeling that's the films he wanted to make, but as a dictator in a communist country, you can't really. So that was his dilemma, and that's why he kidnapped these two filmmakers, because he thought they would kind of enable him to do stuff that was a bit outside of the usual propaganda.
Yeah. So his two things were what? Kidnappings and filmmaking.
Yeah, pretty much any kind of terrorism, you know, kidnapping, hijacking planes, trying to assassinate people,
and making movies.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's another way of terrorizing people, depending upon what film you make. Some of the films actually were good that he made.
The films that the couple who were kidnapped made were quite good. And then, you know, the ones Kim Jong-il himself made with other North Korean filmmakers before them, you know, they were big and loud. They were, you know, the North Korean equivalent of a Michael Bay movie. They were big and violent and schmaltzy. that was his taste.
Uh-huh. And then, but did he actually, in any of it, did he actually do directing or it was, because I, you know, did you see that movie, the Vice thing, I mean, on TV?
I did.
And he said he went there and he got into the studio, which actually was a museum.
Right.
And not really a studio at all. But and they have a big Sea of Blood mural there, which is one of the movies he supposedly produced, right? The big one.
That's right, yeah. And the mural has him kind of standing on the hill overlooking this big battle scene being shot.
Yeah. And with actual blood, you know, I mean, they really can make a movie, I'll tell you that. And the woman there, the guide said that he gave 11,890 guidances during the course of the movie.
Right.
A
guidance means anytime he turned up. So that basically means he turned up on set, you know, 11,000 times.
Yeah.
And because of the communist country, they never kind of, you know, end credits in a film, they never had those, because they wanted to give the impression that everything was kind of collectively, spontaneously created. So it's hard to tell if he ever directed, but the people kind of involved in films say he was there all the time and he micromanaged everything. You know, he was with the writers and he was on set and he did all the stuff that we would associate with directing and producing.
Did he do a walk-on? You ever do a walk-on like Hitchcock?
He never did. There was only one film where they had an actor portray one of the Kims, and allegedly they found an unknown given plastic surgery so he'd look like the Kims, and they sent him off to a prison camp so he wouldn't be able to act in any other film ever again. So that's how seriously they took their kind of own image.
Always a catch. So we, you know, it's kind of amazing. North Korea doesn't make sense according to any other terms other than its own.
Sorry, what's that?
I say North Korea doesn't make sense in any other terms other than its own. For example, all these things that they produce, they'll do these great spectacles, but they won't have an audience for them. It's just to be doing the spectacle. Right?
Right. Yeah, they're sort of spectacles for the sake of spectacle. They're in this weird kind of cycle where, you know, North Korea was created at a time where the Korea was split in two, and they were trying to make the point that there was a more legitimate Korea. And now everyone knows that they're not, and they're a failing state. So they have this sort of, the whole state exists as a show, as a performance, to kind of give the illusion of a state that should still exist, even though it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And that involves them kind of getting caught in these, you know, kind of paradoxical, schizophrenic lapses of reality.
Yeah. But the movies were something different. They started as a propaganda tool, but it was more than that, because he was such a film buff, right? He was such a film buff.
Right. And so it became, you know, the main cultural propaganda tool. It was something where people had to go to the movies. It was compulsory. They had to have conversations about them. They told people in real life to be like the characters they saw in the films. And the whole kind of narrative in North Korea that the people think of as reality was really kind of inculcated through movies, you know, and he kind of wanted to use the movies as a tool to build, you know, this utopia that he was trying to sell to the people.
But that doesn't explain, like, their Godzilla movie.
No, the Godzilla thing was money, really. You know, but in, there's this, you know, for people who don't know, the last movie the kidnapped couple made in North Korea was a Godzilla ripoff, essentially about a communist monster who joins in with the peasants to get rid of an evil landlord. And that was really, you know, the Godzilla films were doing very well in Japan. North Korea at that time was out of money, and Kim Jong-il wanted to find any way he could make money. And a lot of evidence indicates he just thought, oh, yeah, the monster movies make money, we'll make one of those. And that was the motivation, you know, for him to try and make something that could, you know, people would watch abroad and love, and that he'd have his own little pet franchise.
Yeah. And could he not attract actors or directors without kidnapping them?
Well, he thought that he couldn't. He was sort of in a position where, because of the cult of personality, he didn't feel he could tell his own people that there were others in the world more qualified than him. Because, you know, in his mind, that meant, you know, telling the believers that there was someone more divine than God somewhere. So he couldn't admit that. And at the same time, he didn't want to bring anybody else from abroad voluntarily, because that would be sort of conceding that people elsewhere make things better than him and so on. So what he needed was two Koreans that he could sort of repatriate forcibly. And the couple he kidnapped were South Korean, and so he was able to claim that, you know, they're Korean, they're North Koreans, they were ours all along.
Yeah. So it's Shin and Madam Choi.
Right.
And he was the director, and he was a pretty well-known director in South Korea?
He was, yeah, all through Asia, and very well-respected in the world. There was a very respected French film magazine in the 70s that listed him as one of the most sophisticated, influential filmmakers in the world. And having been kidnapped and disappearing off the face of the earth for so long kind of made us forget him a little bit. But he made very sophisticated films in the 1960s, and he also had the first, you know, kind of Hollywood-style studio in Asia with, you know, actors on contracts and stages and backlots. A very big guy and very glamorous. You know, she was a famous actress. They were married. They were kind of like the Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth of Asia at that time.
Yeah, and Madam Choi was like a leading actress in South Korea.
Yeah, leading actress. She made more money than him. She was hugely famous. She'd been involved in some huge scandals. She was one of the first women to direct films in South Korea. She was the first fashion model in South Korea.
Oh, yeah. She was pictured with Marilyn Monroe in that picture that you have. She was on that level in Korea as Marilyn Monroe.
She was, yeah. People called her the Elizabeth Taylor of Asia. People called her the most beautiful woman in Asia. You know, she had that kind of demeanor and class and recognition.
Yeah. And didn't Kim Jong-il, wasn't Elizabeth Taylor one of his favorites as well?
She was, yeah. He would tell people that Sean Connery was his favorite actor, which I guess is a James Bond thing. And Elizabeth Taylor was his favorite actress.
Yeah. So, but he didn't think of kidnapping them.
No, see, because of the racial politics, they had to be Korean.
Oh,
you know, because
yeah,
otherwise, you know, in the kind of politics of Korea, that would have been conceding that another race, as they saw it, was better and, you know, at anything than them, and they can't admit that in the official line.
All right. So, and kidnapping was a cottage industry for North Korea, right? I mean, they had a regular thing. They throw a body bag over you someplace where you don't expect them to be, taking a little dinghy out to a boat that's waiting in the harbor, and you're gone.
Pretty much, yeah. That was the modus operandi. And for about a decade and a half, they did that to, you know, arguably hundreds of people. Some of them, like this couple, were targeted, and others, you know, were just walking along a beach in Japan alone, just at the wrong time, wrong place. And they would be taken, and most commonly those people would then be taken to, this sounds like the plot of a bad movie, but we'd be taken to a spy school. Where they would be used as examples for North Korean spies of this is how a real Japanese person speaks and behaves, and this is how a real South Korean person, Chinese person. You know, and it happened a lot, and at the time no one believed it. It was kind of a boogeyman story. Mm-hmm. You know, so families didn't know what had happened to their family members who just disappeared one day.
Okay. So in this case, they kidnapped these two famous individuals from the South, bring them to North Korea, but he ends up in one horrible prison after another. She's in various places that are nice or something, but she's not. They're really not allowed to do anything. They have to be. Are they waiting for them to be indoctrinated, or what was the deal?
I think the plan was to put them both separately. You know, the way she'd been kept in luxury in a villa, kind of wear them down until they agreed to cooperate. Shin, the filmmaker, kind of made the key mistake of trying to escape twice instead of being grateful for having been kidnapped.
Yeah.
And so as punishment, he was sent to increasingly worsening prison camps until, you know, after 5 years, he kind of realized, yeah, okay, I need to play along if I'm going to try and find an opportunity to get out. And he started playing along, and that's when they were finally reunited and put to work.
Yeah. His escape is attempted escape when he stole the car and got on a train and thought he had escaped. It's sort of like The Prisoner, isn't it?
It is a bit, and the fascinating thing about him was he was someone who was very aware that as a filmmaker, he saw everything in his life as a movie, and in his interviews and memoirs, he talks about being in this harrowing real-life experience, but at the same time in his head, all he can think of is The Fugitive, the TV show, because they had that in Korea at the time, and all he can think of is how can I make this into a movie scene?
Yeah.
So everything has this weird, different layered bit of real and not real and kind of imagined, because they're all such obsessives about film.
Yeah. So it was a lesson in surrealism, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So he's in this prison camp 6. Was that the worst one? Something like
that. That was the worst one, yeah. Prison camp 6. They don't have official names for the prisons in North Korea, so they're just numbered. And that was something that it's the second to worst type of prison camp in Korea, and they call them enlightenment centers, in which they claim that people volunteer to come because of guilty consciences.
Yeah.
To reform themselves, like a rehab. So anyway, he was there for a couple of years, and essentially, you know, they would starve you, force you to sit still all day, and if you moved a muscle, you'd get beaten.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't leave the cell. That was the kind of torture he was putting through.
Yeah. Is that where he escaped from? That was an earlier thing, right?
That was an earlier thing. So he was put in a villa, and then he stole a chauffeur's car in the middle of the night and tried to escape, and that failed. So he was put in a kind of, you know, jail cell, you know, the equivalent of a county jail cell for a couple of weeks, let back out again. He tried to escape again, and then they put him in the more serious camp.
Yeah. That escape is the most cinematic part of the book, don't you think? I mean, that's definitely going to be in the movie, right?
It is, yeah. I mean, it is. Yeah, it's one of the things where I was really grateful when I was double-checking it that everything checked out and that I couldn't put my finger on anything that seemed obviously made up or exaggerated.
Yeah.
You know, and everything fits maps and geography. And you know, he came really, really close in that instance.
Yeah, except he didn't really account for the prevailing mentality. Where nothing is what it seems.
Exactly. But his second escape attempt, you know, by comparison, was terrible. And, you know, it was kind of doomed to fail from the start, whereas the first one was actually a good plan that almost worked.
Yeah. That's like that guy who was lost at sea for all those months just recently. He said, it was unbelievable how many things went wrong.
Exactly.
It was great. Because the car, he was in this building, he couldn't go in or leave by himself anywhere, whatever. But it was living okay, but couldn't go anywhere. And the chauffeur's car, and they all drove these, what, Mercedes? Right?
Right, yeah.
That was the official car of North Korea. And only very few people had them. And the guy left the car, the keys in the car, because who's going to steal a car in North Korea? Because there's so few cars on the road, it's obvious, you know, that it's not your car. So he went in there and got it. It all seemed really easy, and he drove as far as he could, and then he got on this train, and they thought, this is working out perfectly. And they were watching him the entire way and pulled him off the train just before he got to China. That's going to be a good scene. Are you going to direct that yourself?
I don't know that anybody would let us make that film.
Really?
It would be fun to make. Yeah,
film. I think it would be terrific.
It's a big film. It's an expensive film because it kind of ironically costs money to recreate a bankrupt state.
Yeah.
And you've got three Asian leads, you know, two of which are in their 50s, and the other one's a psychopathic midget. You can't really cast Benedict Cumberbatch in it.
That's
so it's
true.
Hard to raise money.
You're right. That's the downside. No Cumberbatch. Got to be someone we can tie to this. That's really amazing. I think it should be a movie. Anyhow, maybe the North Koreans would be interested in it. Maybe Kim Jong-un, you know, as a property. I'm not saying, you know.
We'll pitch it. See what happens.
Yeah, pitch it to him. I want to hear it when that happens. Well, the book is great, and it's called A Kim Jong-il Production. Paul Fisher is the author, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Have a good weekend.
Pleasure. You too. Paul Fisher, FISCHER. Fascinating book.